In their controversial bestseller, Forbidden Archaeology, Michael Cremo and Richard Thompson documented evidence showing that humans have existed on Earth for hundreds of millions of years. Such anomalous evidence, contradicting Darwinian evolution, well, started all kinds of inquiries. If we did not evolve from apes, then where did we come from? Now, human devolution is Michael Cremo's definitive answer to that question. We did not evolve up from matter. Instead, he says, we devolved or came down from the realm of pure consciousness, spirit. In a moment, Michael Cremo on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Cremo is a member of the History of Science Society, the World Archaeological Congress, the Philosophy of Science Association, the European Association of Archaeologists, and a research associate in history and philosophy of science for the, boy, how do I pronounce this, Bhaktivedanta Institute. We'll see if I got close to that. After receiving a scholarship to study international affairs at George Washington University, Michael began to study the ancient histories of India, known as the Vedas. In this way, he has broadened his academic knowledge with the spirituality from the Eastern tradition. And Michael is on the cutting edge of science and cultural issues. In the course of a few months' time, he might be found on a pilgrimage to sacred sites in India, appearing on a national television show in the United States or another country, lecturing at a mainstream science conference, or speaking to an alternative science gathering. As he crosses disciplinary and cultural boundaries, he presents to his various audiences a compelling case for negotiating a new consensus on the nature of reality, and he's back on Coast to Coast AM. Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm fine, George. How are you?
Good, good. Now, how close did I come to pronouncing that right?
Pretty close. Bhaktivedanta.
Bhaktivedanta. Okay, I'll just have you pronounce it from here on in. What have you been doing since we last talked? You've been busy, haven't you?
Well, you know, there's more and more interest than what I've been saying around the world. I'm just continually traveling. Over the past few months, I've been to the United Kingdom. I've been to Estonia, a little country on the Baltic Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be part of the Soviet Union. I really like those people there. They're a very small country, only about 1.5 million people, but they stood up for what they believed was right, and they freed themselves from the Soviet Union in, 10 or 12 years ago. So I like them. And then over the next few months, I'll be going to speak at a few scientific conferences in Europe and in China, and be going later on this year on a 6-week tour of Brazil, where my book, The Hidden History of the Human Race, has been published. So there's been a lot happening in all these areas.
You know, when we first talked, which was back during my days in St. Louis, I was just awestruck with that first book of yours and Richard Thompson's, Forbidden Archaeology. I mean, the depth of the work that you two put into it was one thing, which was magnificent, but the theories, and just it is just so compelling and thought-provoking. I just couldn't put it down. And I mean, that I think, Michael, your theories might be one of the reasons why it continues to drive me to try to search out who we are. There isn't an interview that I have with someone when we're talking about ancient archaeology that I don't quote you or say something about what you've done, because of the fact that I, too, believe that human beings have been around way longer than scientists are telling us.
Well, George, I think we're all, you know, doing our part in this. There's some of us who are doing the research and the writing. There's some of us who are doing these fantastic radio shows and television shows, and there are people who are doing other kinds of work, just learning about this, telling their friends about it. I think one of the great benefits I've had personally of going on shows like yours is having the people call in or write to me after having heard me on your show or some of the other alternative science radio shows, and give me really hard new information that's going to be helpful in putting together a new book that I'm working on now. I'm calling it Forbidden Archaeology 2, which will be more evidence for extreme human antiquity.
Let's talk a little bit about evolution and then devolution, first of all. Evolution, we all generally have a pretty good idea of what that is, though we might not agree with it. The new theory here in the new book, of course, Human Devolution. Tell me about that.
Well, what I'm proposing there is, to put it very simply, is that we didn't evolve up from matter. Rather, we've devolved or come down from a level of the cosmos dominated by pure consciousness or spirit, if somebody likes that word. And what I started out to say was that before we even asked the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? Because today, many scientists are going to say, well, a human being is just a combination of chemicals, a combination of the ordinary material elements. And that kind of limits the kinds of explanations that you can give. You're simply limited to explaining, well, how did the atoms combine together? But I think when we look at all the evidence that comes to us from various fields of scientific investigation, we're going to see that it's more reasonable to say that a human being is a combination of three things. Ordinary matter, yes, that's part of what a human being is. But beyond that, there's a subtle mind element, and beyond that, there's the element of consciousness. And when I speak of mind and consciousness as elements, I don't mean temporary byproducts of bioelectrical activity going on in the brain. I mean that mind is an element, consciousness is an element, just as much as gold and silver are elements. Now, they may be a little more subtle, but they're nevertheless real elements, not simply temporary byproducts of activity going on in the brain. And there's a whole body of scientific evidence that supports that. Now, just as in the case of the archaeological evidence that I talk about in the book Forbidden Archaeology, there's been a lot of what I call knowledge filtration going on. There's a lot of evidence that scientists have collected about these topics that really doesn't get the attention it deserves. So that when many people hear, well, matter, mind, and consciousness, or body, mind, spirit, or something like that, they think, well, that's just sort of some New Age jargon, but that's because they're not really aware of the scientific evidence that backs up these claims.
And you know what? They've probably never even wanted to investigate when they hear these things.
Well, you know, I don't know about that, George, because I think people are very interested in these things, but they turn to the wrong authorities, really, for their answers. They're accustomed to get the answers to their questions about these things from the people that are now dominant in the education system and in the scientific world. But I think the growth of radio programs like yours shows that a lot of people are starting to understand that you've got to turn to some alternative sources of knowledge if you're really going to get close to the truth, and that, you know, you're not necessarily going to get the whole truth from your science textbook in your high school or college classroom, or, you know, by listening to the sorts of scientists you're going to see on PBS or things like that. I think a lot of people are interested in these things. That's what I find all over the world. People all over the world are very interested.
What about mainstream science, though? Are they interested when they hear this, or do they scoff at you?
Well, you know, even the world of mainstream science is changing. It's not as monolithic as it used to be. For example, I was recently invited to give a special talk at the annual meeting of the Society for the Anthropology of Consciousness, which is a division of the American Association of Anthropologists. And so it's a mainstream scientific organization. but still they were interested to hear what I had to say about these topics, because consciousness is something that this particular group of scientists, anthropologists, are interested in. And I went over some of the evidence with them, and they found it really quite interesting. Of course, many of them are also interested in these same kinds of evidence, but you know, the tendency has been to dismiss it. But still, I think if ideas are going to change, the very first thing is that scientists have to be willing to listen to alternatives. And I think many in the scientific world are interested. I've had a lot of experience myself in that. For example, a couple of years ago, I was invited to give a talk at the Department of Nuclear Physics of the main science university in Budapest in Hungary. Mm-hmm. And the audience was about 100 professors of physics and graduate students of physics. So I went through some of this evidence for the mind element. For example, I told them about the case of Marie and Pierre Curie, who are two of the most famous physicists in the world. You know, they were husband and wife. They both got Nobel Prizes in physics for their work in discovering radium. Mm-hmm. And you read about that in every physics textbook. What you don't read in the physics textbook is that they were heavily involved in psychical research. You know, they were doing experiments with mediums, people with psychokinetic abilities, and actually the Curies were part of a group of about 20 prominent European scientists who were doing this kind of research in Paris early in the 20th century. And this whole group, which included 5 Nobel Prize winners, including the Curies, did 2 years of research with a medium named Eusebia Palladino, she was from Italy. And these experiments took place in the Psychology Institute in Paris. And on one occasion, you know, Marie Curie was there controlling the medium, and other scientists were also there. And in the middle of the laboratory, in broad daylight, under carefully controlled experimental conditions, Pierre Curie, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, said that a large table was floating right in the middle of the room. And this wasn't like one of these scenes that, you know, you often see when people want to talk about this stuff in a derogatory way, right, like in some dark living room and who knows what's going on. This was an actual scientific experiment that took place in a scientific institution in Paris with some of the top experimental scientists in the world carefully controlling all the factors. And under those conditions, this woman was able to produce these macro psychokinetic effects. And, I mean, to me, it's evidence for a mind element that can act on ordinary matter in ways that we really can't explain, you know, by our current laws of physics. So I went through a lot of these cases, and at the end I was wondering, what are these physicists going to say?
Cool. And what was the look on their faces while you were speaking to them?
Well, you know, as I said, it's these, even in the world of mainstream science, it's not monolithic. You've got some people who are going to be very dismissive of this sort of thing, you know, your psychop sort of people. And for the listeners who don't know what psychop is, that's a society of skeptics that wants to, you know, just dismiss everything that goes against, you know, their particular way of looking at things. So you've got that kind of person there. But you also have other kinds of people in the world of science who have more open minds, and at least they're willing to give serious consideration to things like this. So one of the professors of physics walked up to me after the talk and said, you know, I'm very glad you gave this talk, because by day I'm doing plasma physics. You know, that's the physics of superheated gases. And he said, but But privately, at night, I'm doing experiments in telepathy. And he told, I put my, my little son in another room, and I flip a coin, and you know, he's got to guess, you know, what it is, heads or tails. And he told me his son was getting over 80% correct.
Oh, yeah, that's way beyond probability.
Way beyond probability. So, you know, he asked me to put him in touch with some psychical researchers, which I agreed to do. But he told me I wouldn't speak about this to my colleagues, because many of them would think I'd gone off the deep end. So that's something I encounter quite a bit as I, you know, travel around the world, that there are scientists who are part of the mainstream and who may, by day, you might say, you know, appear quite orthodox in their activities and thoughts, but who really are harboring some really interesting ideas. And I mean, just another thought along that line. A couple of years ago, I was invited to speak at the geology department of a major university here in the United States.
So you do get a lot of heavyweight assignments to speak at some pretty good universities.
Well, and not only universities, but some of the top scientific institutions in the world. Over the past couple of years, I've been invited to speak at the Royal Institution in London, which is one of the top scientific organizations in England. It's been in existence for 300 years. You know, I've been invited to speak at the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow and other places, and I've also been able to present papers at major international conferences on archaeology, like the World Archaeological Congress, the meetings of the European Association of Archaeologists. So I think the world of even mainstream science it's changing. There still is this very materialistic element there that's very dominant and has a lot of influence. But you've also got people with more open minds, a new generation of scientists, some of whom are willing to go a little bit further than their predecessors have gone.
Well, you know, Michael, for us to talk about the human devolution, you have to talk about your work in forbidden archaeology. Of your thoughts and theories that humans are millions of years old. When did you, and we may have to hold this until we come back from the break, but think about this. What was it that dawned on you that made you decide or think, hey, there's something very different going on here? Human beings are not hundreds of thousands of years old, or in civilizations of 10,000 years old, they have gone back millions of years. Was it the artifacts that you were uncovering and finding, or was it something else?
Well, it wasn't that I was uncovering artifacts that made me start thinking about that. What made me start thinking about this is when I started traveling around the world and investigating the ancient writings of various civilizations. And one of the set of writings I was very interested in was the Vedas, the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. And among those writings, there's a group called the Puranas, or the histories. And I found they spoke of human civilizations that have existed on this planet since the very beginning of the history of life on Earth, going back hundreds of millions of years.
All right, hold that thought right there, Michael, because when we come back, I want to pick up from the Vedas, because this is a startling discussion of what life could have been like, as you say, hundreds of millions of years ago. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Michael Cremo. His website and related websites you can find on coasttocoastam.com right under his name. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast is Michael Cremo. Michael, let's get back to the Vedas and some of the theories of the very, very ancient human existence on this planet.
Well, you're asking what got me started on this forbidden archaeology research, and it was my encounter with these ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which are collectively called Vedas. Veda is a Sanskrit word. It means knowledge. And among the ancient Sanskrit writings is a group called the Puranas or the histories, and they tell of human civilizations that existed millions of years ago. They tell us that humans have been on Earth since the very beginning of the history of the Earth, really. So I found that really quite amazing. And then when I began to look at the writings of other ancient civilizations, I found that they were saying pretty much the same thing, whether you look at the Egyptian writings or ancient Chinese writings or listen to what the ancient Australian Aboriginal account of the history of life on Earth is, or the great civilizations of the Americas, like the Mayans and the Incas and the Aztecs and the Pacific Islanders, the Native American peoples in North America. You look at the Bible, they're all saying pretty much the same thing, namely that humans have been around since the beginning of the history of life on Earth. So until I started looking at what these ancient writings are telling us, I didn't, and take it seriously, I really didn't have any reason to question the accounts of human origins that I learned in high school and at the university. I really didn't have any reason to question it. But when I saw what practically all of these ancient people were saying was the same, that humans had been around since the beginning, that's when I really started to look into the question, is there any physical evidence to support what these ancient writings are saying, or is it just mythology?
If one civilization, one group had mentioned it and none of the others had, would you have just passed over it, do you think?
Well, I don't know. What happened was I found they're all saying the same thing.
Exactly.
So I don't know if I can put myself, you know, back in the situation where I was 30, 35 years ago and tell you what I would have done if it had been different. I mean, what I can tell you is that they all do say the same thing, and that impressed me.
That was remarkable all by itself.
Yeah, that was pretty remarkable. And then what I also found was remarkable is when I started to look in the current scientific literature to see if there was anything I missed and didn't see any evidence at all to support that, well, I thought, well, let me just look a little bit deeper. Let me just go beyond what's in these textbooks, and let me go back to the original scientific reports. Because what you get in a textbook is not the original scientific reports. What you get in a textbook is
an interpretation.
Somebody has selected what to put in that textbook. So I thought, well, let me go back to the original scientific reports of the past 150 years in all different languages. So that's what I started to do, because somehow or other in my education I acquired a reading knowledge of most of the European languages, you know, Russian, German, Italian, French, Spanish. So I began looking into them. I looked at the scientific reports, and what I found was pretty amazing. I found that over the past 150 years, there have been hundreds of discoveries of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints showing that humans like us have been around for millions and millions and millions of years, going all the way back to the very beginning of the history of life on Earth.
I'll remember the two things you told me years ago, Michael, that just continue to stay in my mind. That was the human footprints by the dinosaur prints, and then those steel balls that they found way down within the planet.
Well, those would be the spherical objects found by miners in South Africa, and they're made of a kind of iron called hematite, not steel. But it's a type of iron. And the most amazing feature is the parallel grooves that go around the center of each object. Some of them have two, some of them have three, some of them have four. And metallurgists who examined these said they couldn't explain how they could have formed naturally within the layers of the Earth, you know, especially with, you know, the grooves going around them. And to me, that indicates that they had to have been made by someone with human-like intelligence, but they're found in a mine in South Africa near a place called Ootoes-Dowland in the western Transvaal region. And they're found in mineral deposits over 2 billion years old. And as far as the footprints go, there have been a lot of discoveries of footprints. The ones that you mention of footprints being found alongside the footprints of dinosaurs come from Glen Rose, Texas. And I didn't even mention those. I may have spoken about them to you on the radio show, but I didn't put them in Forbidden Archaeology, in the book Forbidden Archaeology, because at that time when I was doing the research for the book, I still had some questions about them, and I only wanted to put into the book things that I was very, very sure of, that I could document very well. And those footprints were originally reported by a Christian creationist scientist, Dr. Henry Morris, Jr., and he later withdrew his claims about them in a letter that he wrote to Nature, which is one of the big, you know, scientific publications.
Sure.
So I was thinking that, well, because the person who originally reported them has now withdrawn his claims, that raised some doubts in my own mind about those particular discoveries. But later on, there was, and this often happens, sometimes people get in touch with me. So an archaeology student from Texas wrote to me and asked if there was anything she could do to help out with my work. So I said, well, what I'd like you to do is go up to Glen Rose, Texas, the Paluxy River, and have a look at those footprints. So she went up there, and she met some of the investigators that were working up there, and she participated in some new excavations, and she gave me a very thorough report, including photographs, her own personal observations, and reports by other investigators that convinced me that they really do have a very good case there of human footprints and layers of rock about 100 million years old. In those same layers, you can also find, you know, footprints of dinosaurs. Things like this happen a lot. I mean, people do get in touch with me, and they do give me, you know, important new pieces of information. I think one of your listeners just the other day sent me a very interesting report that I'd never heard of before. A man named George McConnell up in Oregon. Yeah, he sent me this very interesting report from a newspaper published in Oregon in the year 1904. And it tells of some miners near a place called Waldo up there who were digging down, and about 60 feet below the surface, they found some stone mortars and pestles, which are human artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
In this heavily cemented gravel, in other words, it wasn't found in some loose deposits. This was found 50 or 60 feet deep, solidly embedded in a solidified conglomerate, you know, where you have gravel and sand and things like that that have hardened to the consistency of cement, basically. And the geological reports that this gentleman referred me to say that these deposits where these objects were found go back to what's called, in geological terms, the Tertiary period, which starts about 2 million years ago and goes back many million years further than that. So these objects then would be at least 2 million years old from right here in America. And according to the current theories that you find in every textbook today, You don't have humans present in the Americas until 20,000 years ago, maximum. And here you've got, you know, there's a very interesting report of human artifacts in America 2 million years old.
And one of the things that I find remarkable about the work you've done, Michael, is that some of the ancient civilizations and the ones that are millions and millions of years old, the technology was better than what we have today.
Well, you can find some indications like that in the documents that these ancient civilizations have left. Now, as far as some of the archaeological discoveries, they may appear a little bit primitive, but I think there are ancient technological remains that could be found. I think one problem is that not very many people are looking for them in a very, very serious way. But, you know, say the ancient Sanskrit writings, for example, speak of spaceships existing millions of years ago. They speak of weapons resembling our modern atomic weapons. They speak of people being able to calculate time according to the movements of atoms. These ancient Sanskrit writings contain descriptions of observations of the human egg, which in Western science they didn't understand until they invented the microscope back in, you know, the 1600s. So thousands and millions of years ago, I think there were technically advanced civilizations who had abilities that were now just starting to recover. But I think the reason for that is that things go in cycles.
Michael, did you ever come across any information, any evidence that would have proven some of these theories, some of these writings, that there might have been some kind of horrible nuclear catastrophe that might have occurred between some of these ancient civilizations?
Well, of course, in the Bible, they have the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, which, if you look at it pretty carefully, resembles a description of a nuclear attack. The ancient Sanskrit writings of India definitely describe the use of weapons resembling nuclear weapons in warfare. They were called Brahmastras, technically. So you do find reports here and there. You know, for example, once, and this report is pretty common on the Internet. You can find it in a lot of different places, that at a place called Kurukshetra in India, where one of these battles took place, there's a report that some scientists found an area of vitrified sand, which means sand that's turned to glass, which is what you see at Alamogordo in, you know, New Mexico, where the first American bomb was tested. So, but when I looked more carefully into that report, I wasn't able to track down any of the scientists that were mentioned, and I wasn't able to track down any exact detailed information about the exact location of the area of sand that had turned to glass. So sometimes you find that in some of these reports, that they're very interesting, but sometimes when you dig a little bit deeper, you're not able to actually verify, you know, the information in these reports. So even as an alternative science researcher myself, I'm inclined, you know, to accept these things, and I believe they're true. But I find if I'm going to present information to people in a credible way, sometimes I need a little bit more than you get in some of these reports.
Well, that's true.
There are a couple of ways to learn about the past. One way is to dig into the earth and look for what you can find there. Now, that's you've got certain limitations, because geologists tell us that over 95% of the sedimentary layers that have ever been laid down on Earth have been worn away by different kinds of erosion. So that means, say if we want to look at the layers of the Earth as a big book, say 1,000 pages long, 950 pages are gone, you know, of the book. So one problem is that it's not a complete record. So, but I think what is there is very significant. I think there are indications of advanced technological civilizations, but I think there's more evidence to be found. But what we need is a new generation of researchers who are prepared to go out there and look for it and find it.
Is it possible that some of this evidence could be buried thousands of feet underground for some reason?
In some places, that could happen. For example, you go to the Grand Canyon, you've got, you know, several thousand feet of deposits. Now, in some places, the very ancient deposits are at the surface, and in some places, they're very far down under the surface. So in each particular place, you know, you have to take into account what the geological situation is.
You know, Michael, when we come back, because we're approaching the top of the hour, let's find out then how you tie in the human devolution with the physical finding of man, and how you talk about that we didn't evolve from matter, but primarily the consciousness and spirit. Did that include then some kind of divine intervention, in your opinion?
Well, I think people are looking for pretty simple explanations in a lot of cases. These days, I think you've got three main explanations for human origins. One is divine intervention. The other is a very simple evolution account. You know, the chemicals combine together to form the first living thing, and they gradually turn into monkeys, ape men, and human beings. And then you've got the extraterrestrial, very simple extraterrestrial intervention ideas. And what I think is the case is things are a little more complicated than the supporters of those ideas can imagine, and that what we've really got is a very complex interaction between that includes some kind of divine intervention, some overall, you know, design and control by some kind of cosmic intelligence. You've also got an extraterrestrial aspect to it because I believe that life is present not just on Earth, but it's scattered throughout the universe and not just on one dimension, but on higher dimensions as well. And you've also got a kind of evolution going on that I call devolution. It's a very complex web.
And let's talk about that web when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with our guest, Michael Cremo. Michael, does the theory here of human devolution, does it coincide with the things that you found in the forbidden archaeology?
Well, what I found in forbidden archaeology, I believe, just tells us we need a new explanation of human origins. I mean, there's just so much physical evidence that contradicts what we're now being told about human origins in antiquity, that it becomes necessary to start thinking about new ideas. So that's what forbidden archaeology does. It just tells us we've got all this evidence that humans existed millions and millions of years ago. It means we need a new explanation. But what I've proposed in human devolution is that before we even get involved in that, we have to take a closer look at what a human being really is. We should know what it is we're trying to explain. And many scientists are going to say, well, we're just a combination of ordinary matter.
Mm-hmm.
But
and we changed and evolved over the years.
Yes, materially. But I think if we look at all the evidence that comes to us from science, we're going to see that a human being is more than just a combination of matter. There's also a subtle mind element that has the ability to act on ordinary matter in some very unusual ways that some people call psychic powers or paranormal powers and things like that. So I think that has to be taken into account. And then beyond that, there's a conscious self that can exist beyond the body, beyond the mind in its own right. And there's a whole body of scientific evidence for that, too. So what this does is it kind of takes us out of the realm of the stones and bones, you know, that I talked about in forbidden archaeology and into other areas of forbidden knowledge. And there's been a lot of knowledge filtration going on in this area. But I think if we actually look at all the evidence and not just what we see in the current textbooks, we're going to see that a human being is a combination of matter, mind, and consciousness, and that this leads to another idea, namely that our whole cosmos is a multi-level cosmos divided into different levels, each dominated by one of these elements and inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. So we find ourselves now on the level of the cosmos dominated by ordinary matter. But beyond that, there's a level of the cosmos dominated by the subtle mind element and inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there, who have been traditionally called angels, gods, goddesses, astral beings, extraterrestrials, or whatever.
Well, what really got you thinking this way? Because this is not hard evidence like your first work.
Well, there actually is what I would call a body of hard evidence. There are two things that got me thinking about it. One is the ancient wisdom traditions, which all speak of these things, but there's also a body of scientific evidence that tends to support this idea that there is a subtle mind element and that there are beings that inhabit this realm of the subtle mind. I was mentioning in the first hour the work of Madame Curie, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist who was involved in studying mediums who had psychokinetic abilities. There's work going on like this even today. Dr. Robert John, who was the dean of the engineering department at Princeton University, started doing experiments with random number generators. And, you know, random number generators,
right.
You know, those are the machines that will generate as an output a series, random series of zeros and ones. And if you let the machines run by themselves, they generate 50% ones, 50% zeros, but Dr. John and his colleagues recruited students from Princeton University to sit in front of these machines, and simply by mental intention alone, they were able to cause the machines, for example, to generate more ones than zeros, or more zeros than ones, according to their mental intention. So to me, this is evidence for a subtle mind element that can act on ordinary matter in ways that we really can't explain by our current laws of physics. So if we're going to talk about human origins, I think we have to go beyond, you know, the DNA and the molecules and the atoms, and we have to talk about this subtle mind energy as well. And then beyond that, there's a conscious self that can exist beyond the mind, beyond matter. And there's evidence for that. It comes from medical reports of out-of-body experiences, for example. It comes from psychiatric reports of past life memories that indicate that a conscious self can go from one physical body to another physical body through a process of transmigration or reincarnation. So when you put it all together, you see that a human being is more than atoms and DNA. You know, that there is a subtle mind element there, and then beyond that, there's this element of consciousness. And from there, you have to explain, if you want to explain human origins, then you have to explain, well, where did all these things come from? Where did the matter come from? Where did this subtle mental energy come from? Where did this element of consciousness come from? And to me, that indicates that in our cosmos, there are reservoirs, there are regions of these different elements. And what I'm proposing in this book, Human Devolution, is that we begin our existence on the topmost level of pure consciousness, or spirit, if you like that word, and that we, if we become attracted to these lower energies, then that conscious self descends into them and becomes covered by them, and that's where we find ourselves now. But as I said, there is a lot of hard evidence to support this in the forms of these experiments done by very prominent scientists showing the existence of a mind element and also showing the existence of an element of consciousness.
But it was always there, though, wasn't it?
Well, yes, people in the past have been very much more aware of these things than perhaps many of us today are. But this scientific evidence has been there. It still is there today, but it's been subjected to this knowledge filtering process by those who want to keep us focused on the world of ordinary matter. They like seeing us simply absorbed in the production and consumption of more and more material things. It generates a lot of material wealth. And if we were distracted from that process, there would be some pretty huge political, economic, and sociological effects. You know, if people were to put, say, more energy into developing the resource of consciousness than they put into the development of matter, yeah, that would have some tremendous economic implications. Just after 9/11, because people became a little bit frightened and they began just staying home and not going out and purchasing things,
right,
or flying on airplanes,
things shut down.
They just want to sit with their friends and their relatives and just talk about, well, what is this world coming to? What is the purpose of life? What's going on here? And because they did that, because they stopped this production and consumption a little bit, the economy went down worldwide a few percentage points, and that caused political shockwaves all over the world. You know, we have to see our president go on television and say, travel, fly, go to shopping centers,
yeah,
purchase.
Yeah.
So I think that shows why some forces in this world want to keep us focused simply on the idea that we're purely material beings. Because if we are purely material beings, then we're going to stay absorbed in this process of material production and consumption.
How did these ancients,
which is benefiting a lot of people?
Of course. How did these ancients know this, and we still have a heck of a time trying to figure it out?
Well, I think everybody has some sense of these things, because even in a country like the United States of America, 90% of the people have some experience of these things. There have been Gallup surveys done. 60% of the people believe in UFOs, and many of them claim to have had UFO experiences. 40 to 50% of the American people claim to have had communications with the dead or other types of psychic or paranormal experiences.
Sure. Well, and all you got to do is turn on your television and look at what the hot shows are.
Sure.
You know.
So I think, see, the thing is that most people in the world have never stopped accepting these things. But it's as if we've been hijacked. You know, say if you may have a lot of people on a 747, you may have 400 or 500 people, but it just takes a few hijackers to, you know, control the plane. And, you know, so I think that's the situation we're in this world today, that most people in their hearts and in their lives accept the kind of things that I'm talking about. But we've got very influential groups of people, scientists, politicians, industrialists, and others, who have a different idea. They've more or less hijacked the human civilization, you could say, and they've turned it in a certain direction. We may have been wanting to fly, and just like the people when they get on the airplane, they think they're going to go somewhere. They've paid to go in a certain direction, but the hijackers take them in another direction, and there's not too much they can do about it unless they find a way to take the plane mm-hmm. back under control, which can be pretty difficult. So I think that's the situation we're in today. Most people have never stopped believing in these things, but the people who are now in charge of the airplane, you could say, have a different idea, and they're trying to take us in another direction. I think we've got to somehow or other get back in control of our lives and put ourselves in the right direction.
The subtitle of this book, Human Devolution, says a Vedic alternative to Darwin's theory. What does that mean?
Well, I say that because my work is inspired by my studies in these ancient Sanskrit
right.
writings, but at the same time, I realize that they're part of a larger spiritual family of alternatives to Darwinism. In other words, I'm not claiming to have some exclusive monopoly on the truth. I recognize that the world's great spiritual traditions, whether we're talking about Christianity or Islam or Judaism or Buddhism or Native American traditions, they all pretty much say the same thing. If you look deeply enough, they all say, humans have been around since the very beginning of the history of life on Earth. They all say that this is not our real home, that we've come from some higher level of reality. They all say there's life scattered throughout the universe. They all say that we live in a multi-level cosmos. Now, they may have different terminologies, but if you really look closely at them, you'll see that they have a lot in common. So when I say, I'm offering a Vedic alternative, I'm just being honest that, well, among all the traditions that are out there, this is the one I found
right.
That works for me.
Did they get it during that period of time? I mean, were they?
Well, I think they did, because if you look at the descriptions of what the world was like, because these descriptions of these ancient civilizations at these times when they understood not just the ordinary people, but the people in the government, the people who were actually running the society, but they understood that we are part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings, that prosperity on Earth depends on our proper relationships with beings at other levels of this cosmic hierarchy. Things apparently were going a lot better than they are today. So I guess what I'm trying to accomplish in my work, and I'm not alone in this. I look at myself as one member of a large group of researchers that are in their different ways trying to move things in a certain direction. For example, 2 years ago I spoke at the Crop Circle Symposium in Glastonbury, England, and I had the good fortune to meet Dr. John Mack, who was the Harvard
sure.
psychiatrist. Who,
God rest his soul, huh?
Yeah, I mean, who... And so he came up to me after my talk, and he said he was appreciating a lot of things that I was saying. And I was also appreciating his work, because I cite his work extensively in Human Devolution. For those of your listeners who don't know, he was the Harvard psychiatrist who became interested in these UFO alien abduction accounts, and he investigated these people very carefully, and he found that they're not psychotic, they're not neurotic, they are sane people who are reporting experiences in a truthful way, and they're displaying the symptoms of people who have undergone some traumatic experience.
Put his career on the line, Michael. He did.
Yes, he did. And his colleagues at Harvard tried to get his tenure revoked.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they want to get him removed from his position. Now, he successfully fought that.
And then
so
he gets killed.
He was the person that, huh?
And then he gets killed, hit by a car.
That's right. That happened in England last year.
Yeah.
And I was very sorry to hear about that because we had agreed to stay in touch with each other.
Mm-hmm.
and try to coordinate our activities a little bit. But so I think that was very unfortunate. But I guess the point I was making is I don't see myself as a kind of lone crusader in what I'm doing. I see myself as part of a group of researchers representing a lot of people on this planet who would like to see things move in a little bit different direction than they're moving now.
Michael, the work that you've done in terms of the past civilizations on this planet, did you ever come across anything that would lead you to believe that we were visited, seeded, jump-started by aliens or extraterrestrials?
Yes, but I think it's a little more complicated picture than that, because the way I look at it, we're not just dealing with extraterrestrials in the sense of beings that live on other planets on our level of reality. Because I think there are other dimensions of reality. I was mentioning this dimension of the subtle mind element, which according to many traditions and a lot of scientific evidence, is full of astral beings, gods, goddesses, things like that. Even when you look at the extraterrestrial phenomenon, you've got two sets of researchers. One is the nuts and bolts type of researcher, which wants to see extraterrestrials as sort of material beings like ourselves who have just developed a little bit more advanced technology and are making machines made of ordinary matter and operating according to physical laws and things like that, but coming from other planets or other solar systems. But a lot of the researchers these days, when they look at this UFO phenomenon, the alien phenomenon, people like John Mack, for example, see that it starts to shade into the paranormal.
Hold that thought, Michael. We'll be right back. I want you to finish that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Michael, you were just getting into something fascinating about the UFOs and whether we had been seated or not. You were also talking about John Mack again, so I'll let you pick up that story.
Well, yes, we have been seated, I believe, but not necessarily in the way that some people would think that that there are other intelligent life forms similar to us materially that exist on some other planet on our particular level of reality, sort of like some super scientist like our Earth scientists, but a little more advanced, who have come and maybe just put some DNA down here. I think there's more to it involved than that. And this gets back to the idea that we're not just DNA and molecules, that that's part of what we are, but you've also got this mind element and this element of consciousness. So I think we're talking not so much about just extraterrestrial beings in the simplistic way of speaking about them, but what I would call extra-dimensional beings who are responsible for seating us here. And because I think what's really important, say, about Dr. John Mack's work is that that's the conclusion that he came to as well, that we live in a multi-level cosmos.
Right.
And he said that in his last book, I think anybody who really looks at all the evidence is going to come to that conclusion as well, that we're not just material beings existing in a material cosmos, that we're very complex beings with elements of matter, mind, and consciousness put together in a very complex way that couldn't just happen by chance. I think when scientists actually look at even the complexity of the materialistic part of the human being, they find it's very difficult to explain just in terms of the atoms combining by chance in the Earth's early ocean to form some first living thing or something like that. I think anybody who really looks at this matter carefully is going to see that there's some intelligence involved. And I don't think it's the kind of intelligence that would be manifested simply by some other type of material being on our level, I think there are more intelligent beings that exist on higher levels of reality that are responsible for seeding us here.
Could we be talking also about parallel universes and things like that?
Well, that's pretty interesting because the ancient Sanskrit writings of India speak of millions of universes, not just one. And this is an idea that's come up in only recently in modern science as a way to get around the fact that the universe, the one universe that we live in, appears to have been intelligently designed for life to exist in it. And when cosmologists and astrophysicists look at the universe, they find that there are some constants of nature, there are some physical laws, there are some ratios of natural forces that are so finely tuned that if they were even slightly different, there wouldn't be life in our universe.
Sure.
For example, the ratio of the mass of a proton to the mass of an electron in an atom is very, very finely tuned. And if it were even slightly different, then we wouldn't have stable atoms, there wouldn't be stable molecules, there wouldn't be stars and planets or any of the living things that we observe. And it's not that just there's just one of these ratios that's like that. There are many of them. Sir Martin Rees, the Royal Astronomer of England, wrote a very interesting book, Six Numbers, where he looked at six of these ratios of different natural forces. And if any of them were slightly different, we just wouldn't have a universe fit for life. So to get around that, what some astronomers have done is proposed, well, there are millions of universes, and we just where these forces are adjusted in different ways randomly, and we just happen to have won the lottery. Of course, that's a very speculative idea. Nobody's ever seen one of these other universes, and to prove that idea, you'd have to see them and show that there's not life in them. But according to the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, there are millions of other universes, and there's life in all of them. It's not that we've won the lottery. All of the universes are designed for life.
Teeming with
them.
What do you think of Zechariah Sitchin's work with those Sumerian texts?
I think if people read my books or they listen to what I have to say, see, normally I don't talk so much about other researchers and things like that. But if somebody asks me a question, then I'll reply to it. As far as I know, like you say, he's approaching things from the perspective of the ancient Sumerian writings, and I'm kind of taking things from the ancient Sanskrit writings. Maybe other researchers are looking at the Egyptian writings, and others looking at the Mayan calendar and writings and things like that. So I think when I look at all of these, whether it's the Sumerian or the Vedic or the Egyptian or the South American or whatever, you're going to find some differences, but you're also going to find some commonalities. So the things that I would have in common with Sitchin's work, as far as I can tell, is yes, there is life on other planets. We have been visited by extraterrestrials, and I would say extra-dimensionals in the way I would say it. As far as the ideas that I understand he has about the antiquity of the human race, I think his idea, if I understand it properly, is that evolution went on pretty much as the Darwinist scientists today say it went on, up to the point of Homo erectus, or one of the ape men that existed around 300,000 or 400,000 years ago.
Right.
And at that time,
it was altered.
There was some alteration, and that's when we get the first anatomically modern human beings. Now, the research that I did in forbidden archaeology leads me to have a different idea, namely that anatomically modern humans existed far longer ago than 400,000 years ago.
And from the get-go, in terms of what they were, right? I mean, they were human beings instantly?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, for example, in Italy, you can find at Castagnetolo discoveries of anatomically modern human skeletons and layers of rock about 4 million years old. Discoveries like this were also made in a place called Savona in Italy, and one of my readers, he wrote to me and asked if there were anything he could do, so I said, well, maybe you can track down those Savona bones. So he actually tracked them down. They're in a museum in Rome now, I think, and he sent me a photograph of these bones, which come from layers of rock about 4 million years old from this other place. And then you've got discovery, well, in America, there was, in the year 1862, a scientific journal called The Geologist, you know, published a report that an anatomically modern human skeleton had been found 90 feet below the surface of the ground in Macoupin County, Illinois. And we got in touch with geologists of the state of Illinois, and we asked them, well, how old are the layers of rock at that level, at that particular place? And they told us, well, that formation is about 300 million years old, which is from before exactly. The time of the dinosaurs.
And there's no way that skull could get down there, or, you know, some riverbed would take it downstream and down into a crevice somewhere. That couldn't happen.
Well, not in that particular case. Such things can happen, because you know, it depends on the geological situation.
Sure.
Now, according to the report, in that particular place, there was a thick layer of slate rock that extended for just huge areas in all directions, completely sealing the skeleton off from the surface. So in that case, and that layer of rock was unbroken. So perhaps, you know, if you could have shown, well, yes, that there was some old river channel or crevice or something that had broken the layer of rock through which a skeleton could have come down from some higher level. But according to the report published in this scientific journal, that wasn't the case here. The skeleton was completely sealed off from the surface by a thick layer of slate rock extending for hundreds of yards in all directions.
It's almost like these spheres you were talking about in the first hour.
Yeah. Now, if there were just a couple of cases like this, I mean, maybe it wouldn't be so significant, but there are hundreds of them, and I'm learning about more of them every day. I mentioned in one of the, you know, previous hour, you know, a case that was just reported to me by one of your listeners. So in terms of Sitchin's work, there are some things I would agree with him about. Yes, there are extraterrestrials. Yes, the Earth has been visited, but as far as the antiquity of the human race, I'd put it further back in time than he does.
There are also some who believe that the beings on this planet, as you say, just seem to have been here. But if that's the case, Michael, if they were just humans from the get-go, did they still evolve on this planet, or are you saying that they were plopped down here?
Well, I would say they were put here, and they were given suitable vehicles to carry out their
mission, purposes. Their mission, whatever.
Because, you know, just say, what I'm proposing is we really belong on some other level of the cosmos, the level of pure consciousness or spirit. That's where we belong. If we drift down from there, you know, if we become attracted to the lower energies, then we kind of enter into them. We become covered by them, and the coverings take the form of different kinds of bodies. Just like, you know, if we want to go into some other element, for example, if I want to go into the water, you know, for more than a minute or so that I can hold my breath, I've got to have a suitable vehicle. You know, I've got to have a submarine or a diving suit or something. If I want to exist in the air, you know, if I want to fly in the air, I have to have a suitable vehicle. So when we come down to this level of reality, we need a suitable vehicle. And this human form is a vehicle for existing on this level of reality. Now, there are other forms that can also exist on this level of reality. We see there are so many forms of bodies of plants and animals and things like that. And I believe they also have conscious cells in them. But according to, you could say, the particular desire of the conscious self, it'll get a certain type of vehicle. So, and then by, I think there is a kind of evolution that goes on, not the kind that the Darwinists talk about, but there's an evolution of consciousness whereby when a conscious self becomes more aware, it gets a better vehicle, the best type of vehicle on this level being the human vehicle, you know, the human body. So I think there is a kind of evolution that of consciousness that goes on whereby a conscious self can move up through, you know, different forms of bodies till it gets to the human form. So there is a kind of evolution that goes on, but the different vehicles are there. You know, just like there's so many kinds of cars, you know, different prices, different models. You can get one kind of car or another kind of car, and in the course of a person's life, he may evolve through different types of cars. You may buy a used car when you're very young, and, mm-hmm. and as your income increases, maybe you evolve up through different types of cars. You're still the same person, but you and all the cars are always there, but according to your income,
your likes
you might
and
get a
dislikes.
Better one. Yeah.
You have a complete chapter devoted to apparitions, angels, and aliens, and I find that to be fascinating in a book about human evolution and devolution. Why that chapter?
Well, because what I'm proposing is that we live in a multi-level cosmos, and with each level of the cosmos being inhabited by different types of beings. So some people are going to ask, well, where's this evidence for different types of beings existing on, you know, different levels of the cosmos? And I believe there is evidence for that. One category of such evidence comes from communications from humans that once exist on this level but that have gone to some other level of the cosmos. And that means these communications with the dead, you know, that sometimes people experience. Then there are apparitions of departed humans. This also happens. There are also cases of possession of living humans by spirits of humans that have departed from this level and who have gone to some other level. A very interesting case was reported by William James, who was the father of modern psychology. And in his textbook, printed early in the 20th century, called Principles of Psychology, he describes a very interesting case of spirit possession that he considered to be a genuine case. It was called the Watseka Wonder. Watseka is a little town in Illinois, and there was a girl there named Lorancy Venom. And she lived a normal life until one day she went into a trance state, and she reported being possessed by the spirit of another girl who had died some years before. Her name was Mary Roth. And it caused some very interesting events to take place. She began to feel like a stranger in her own family, and when she was introduced to members of the Roth family, who she'd never met before, she immediately recognized them, she immediately identified with them, and finally, the parents of both families agreed that she should go and live with the Roth family. And when she did that, she manifested the personality of the Roth's departed daughter, Mary. She displayed knowledge of all the family's detailed intimate affairs going back many years, things that would have only been known to Mary Roth, the girl who had died a few years before. And this went on for several months until later the girl went into another sort of trance state. And she informed, she was informed, you know, by the spirit who had been possessing her that this spirit, Mary Roth, was going to go back, you know, to the level of reality where she was, you know, she had come from. And so for some time, both personalities were manifest, but finally, you know, the personality of Mary Roth left, and then this girl, she felt like a stranger in the Roth house. She immediately felt homesick for her own family, and then, you know, both families agreed she should go back. So what I found significant about this case is, first of all, it was reported by a really famous scientist, a very famous psychologist, William James, in a textbook of psychology. And, of course, these things are still being reported to this present day, but this is a very good case. So then other categories of evidence would include apparitions of superhuman beings. Things like this often happen. You have angel apparitions, apparitions of extraterrestrial beings, apparitions of the Virgin Mary in some countries, and things like that. You also have cases of possession of humans on this level by these superhuman beings, which can be of a divine or sometimes a demoniac nature, as in the case of that movie The Exorcist.
All right, let's talk a little bit about that when we come back, Michael. And also, we'll open up the phone lines. It's your turn to talk with Michael Cremo on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Cremo, our guest. Michael, by the way, the book, Human Devolution, let's talk about where you can get it before we go to these massive phone calls. Where can you find it?
Well, you can find it on my website, mcremo.com, mcremo.com. There's also a toll-free number, 1-888-465-3686, 888-465-3686. It's available in bookshops and internet booksellers as well.
Amazon get it? They have
it? Yes,
it
does.
Okay,
yes,
very good. Okay, and Human Devolution also is a related website, so that is linked up right now to you on coasttocoastam.com. You can get right to it. I think we may have helped crash your M. Crema website, by the way.
Oh,
Sorry, Michael, but we just sent a few million people your way and just jammed the whole thing up. The work that you have done also has got to irritate some people. You get a lot of publicity. You get exposure. You know, you're a favorite on Coast to Coast. How do some of these other scientists feel about the kind of publicity you generate?
Well, some of them don't like it very much. I think Richard Leakey said some nasty things about me once, like, your book is pure humbug. Nobody would take it seriously but a fool. NBC television special, Mysterious Origins of Man, that I was a consultant for and appeared on, was the Darwinist Scientists of America tried to stop NBC from showing it. When it did air, they went to the FCC and tried to get the FCC to fine NBC for having run this program. And so there is that element there that would like to see me banned from the airwaves and never be allowed to speak at a university. I went to one European country, and the scientists there passed a resolution that I shouldn't be asked to speak at any of the universities there. But so you do get that kind of reaction. But
I think your theories are refreshing.
Yeah, and as I said, the world of science itself is not monolithic. There is this, what I would call, fundamentalist Darwinist element there that doesn't like me very much and wouldn't like, you know, to hear me speak at their university or at one of their conferences. But there are people who do like to hear me, even within the mainstream scientific world. I'm always getting invitations to, you know, speak at different scientific conferences and universities. So it's I think it's what I see is that we're in the middle of what I call a fundamental renegotiation of our whole picture of reality. And I think there are a lot of participants in that renegotiation. There are people like me from the alternative science community, people like yourself, mainstream scientists, ordinary people who may be members of different religious organizations or whatever, or paranormal people, UFO researchers. I think there's a whole movement going on now, and I think the end result is we're going to come to a new consensus about the nature of reality in terms of the dominant ideas in our society.
All right, let's go to the phones. You ready, Michael?
Sure.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with our guest, Michael Cremo. Hi there.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. And where are you, sir?
My name is Charles. I'm calling from Maryland. Now, I was in Virginia when I first called.
Driving through. Go ahead, Charles.
Yes, I do. This question is not intended to offend anyone that may be listening, but I just thought about this when I was listening to your guest. It just popped in my head. Talking about ancient civilizations and ancient people, and comparing the ancient people to today's people, you know, all your nationality of people having round eyes, do you guess believe, like I say, I don't intend to offend anyone, do you believe that the Asian, more specific, the Japanese could be like ancient crossbreeds of alien race? You know, being that genetics and today, how, you know, they are considered more intelligent than other people, could they be like a descendant of like a crossbreed of human and aliens?
All right. Well, I'll let you sink your teeth in that, Michael and Charles. You can listen on your radio. What about those possibilities?
Well, I think we're all. You know, extraterrestrials, we've all come down from some higher level of reality, and I think we've all got, we may, each of ourselves, be more intelligent than we think we are. You know, so in terms of that, since I think all of the beings here on Earth have come from the same place, really, I think really we're all of the same level of intelligence if we could access it all. So I think each one of us, as a conscious being, as a spirit self, is equal. Now, I do believe, however, that there are among people on Earth some who have these the sort of ancestry that he's talking about. If you look at what the traditional Japanese account of their ruling family is, the idea is that they were originally descended from some goddess connected with the sun, and they came to this planet to carry out some activities here, and that's the distinction that they make. But this is something that we find in other cultures as well. In the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, it's described that the royal families had either a connection with the sun god or the moon god, and some of them were members of these royal families. It said that they were, that part of their ancestry was terrestrial and some connected with these divine beings. You know, for example, there was one group in the royal families called the Pandavas, and they had a joint ancestry like that, a terrestrial mother, divine fathers. And it's something that you find repeated in practically all the different wisdom traditions down through history. If you examine them, you'll see that there are some earth people who have these two strains in their ancestry, terrestrial and extraterrestrial. But ultimately, I would say we're all extraterrestrials. I mentioned this devolution process, that we didn't evolve up from matter, that we've all devolved or come down from some higher level of the cosmos, a level dominated by pure spirit or consciousness. And it's a process that can be reversed. There's a process of spiritual re-evolution, and we can all access our original nature, which is extraterrestrial, ultimately.
Michael, what do you think Charles Darwin would say if he had a chance to meet with you?
Some people say I'm a reincarnation of Charles Darwin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they say I've come back. I've had to take another birth
with a change
to correct the little mistake that I made. So maybe that I'm talking to myself right now.
Maybe.
But I actually have quite a bit of respect for Charles Darwin because at a time when nobody accepted his ideas, he had the courage to stand up and say, "Well, this is what I believe." Now, after 150 years, I would say, if he were to come back, I'd say it was a good try, Chuck. Good try, Charles. But I think after 150 years of trying, the evidence really doesn't support what you're saying in your book, The Origin of Species. And I think he was probably enough of a gentleman and enough of a scholar to change his ideas. Now, I think his modern supporters are in a different position. I think they've adopted their position, not so much from a scientific point of view, but from an ideological point of view, and I don't know if they'd be prepared to give it up. I think he was enough of an intellectual and a scholar and a scientist and a gentleman to realize that after 150 years, his idea didn't work out.
Let's go to first-time caller line. You're up. Hi there.
Hi, this is Angel. I'm from Peoria. Hi, Michael. Hi, George.
Hi, Angel. How are you?
Hi, Angel.
I'm pretty good. I want to say I agree with what you're saying. And I just wondering, you said that we've devolved, and do you think that our self-awareness or our consciousness is affected by the things that we eat today, like a lot of fast food and just the things that we think, our thoughts?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, for 35 years, I've been a vegetarian. I don't, try to, push it on other people. But since you're asking about it, yes, I do believe that what we eat does affect our consciousness. And I've tried to make sure that my eating habits are in line with, my values and what I believe. So that's led me to a vegetarian diet. And also I think that there's a little bit more to that as well. I think the consciousness with which you prepare food and in these ancient civilizations and the idea was that all these things that we eat are being provided to us by higher power. So there was some recognition of that. And even today, people will say grace or something as some kind of recognition that, we're existing on gifts that have been provided to us. So I think that's also important, and that's something I try to take into account as well.
Okay, thanks, Angel. I appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, good morning, George. Good morning, guest.
Yes.
I'm a physician assistant, and I review lab tests all the time for people that are going to surgery, and there's such a delicacy. Like, if you take the potassium, the certain potassium concentration, it's so small that minor changes in the concentration, they have a significant consequence on the human being, and that's just potassium. But what about the mind? When you talked about matter, mind, and consciousness all being put together in a complex way, to be honest with you, my wife has schizophrenia. When she decompensates and she doesn't take her medicine, she says the most profound things. I won't go into them now, but it's like we seem to be masking something that might be eye-opening. The psychiatrists, I have a lot of respect for them, but a lot of times they suppress a lot of things by giving them medications. George, you had a guest on Dr. Abramson's,
yes.
Overdose in America. Remember that one?
I
live with a situation like this. And sometimes when my wife gets off of her medicine, she'll say things that nobody I've ever gone to school with or anything else. And not like a savant, but, I mean, do we suppress things sometimes when we should be exploring it?
Well, I think you're right about that, and I think our whole medical system has evolved in concert with this whole trend towards materialism, because if you think that a human being is just a combination of chemicals, if you think that that's all there is to the brain, to the body, then you're going to have a medical system that's going to concentrate on drugs, basically, because drugs are molecules, and you think, well, if I can inject somebody or give somebody some molecules that will adjust their molecules, that's going to solve their problem. Now, that may solve part of the problem, but that doesn't address the mind and the conscious self. So I think what alternative medical systems that existed in these ancient civilizations were aware of, they were aware, much more aware of the connections between the body, between the mind, and between the conscious self. And they were able to put into their medical systems techniques and that would take all of that into account, whereas we're just focusing on the bottom level and not aware of the subtle connections between the body, between the mind, and the conscious self. So I think if you look at Ayurveda, if you look at Chinese medicine, if you look at all these alternative medical systems, you'll see that if you look at the physiology that they were working with, it was a physiology that didn't include just the gross physical body, but also the subtle body of mind and intelligence, and beyond that, the actual conscious self. And they took all of those things into account. So I think you're right that just by trying to deal with these very subtle problems with just chemical interventions may be not the proper way to go about it. It may be partially helpful. Undoubtedly you can do something with these chemicals, but I think it's not reaching to the real depths of the person, the self, the mind.
Michael, when you were doing your work into these ancient civilizations, the ones that, you say are millions and millions of years old, was there anything there that just really was earth-shattering to you when you found it out?
Well, what I found most earth-shattering, you could say, is not any particular case of evidence for extreme human antiquity or anything like that. What I found most earth-shattering was the amount of evidence that has been subjected to this knowledge filtering process. All the archaeological evidence, all this research into the paranormal by famous scientists, all this evidence that we live in a multi-level cosmos that's designed for life, all this evidence for the existence of beings existing at different levels of this cosmic hierarchy. That's what I found most earth-shattering, that there's so much evidence like this that has been filtered out of our normal knowledge system. And that's something I would like to see changed, because I think what's happened is that you've got a very relatively small but influential group of scientists who have some very materialistic conceptions of life, who have more or less hijacked our education system, and they've somehow or other induced our government through its judicial system to say that only their ideas can be taught in the official education system. I think that's got to change.
All right, we'll be back. We'll take final phone calls. It'll be our final segment in just a moment. On Coast to Coast AM, I'm George Norrist. Michael, how advanced was the Vedic civilization compared to other civilizations on the planet at the time?
It seems to have been pretty advanced. As I mentioned earlier in the show, the ancient Sanskrit writings speak of vimanas, or spacecraft, and they had different kinds. Some of them were capable of traveling to ordinary planets like ours on our level of reality, but they also had extra-dimensional craft that could travel up and down through the cosmic hierarchy, going all the way up to the level of pure consciousness. So they had quite a bit of communication with the other levels of the cosmic hierarchy of beings that we're part of, levels that we currently are not communicating with.
Well, if they have this kind of craft and this kind of technology, how do we know that they weren't visitors as opposed to, you know, earth beings, earthlings?
Well, we're all visitors, according to the human devolution concept, because we've all come from that topmost level of the cosmos, the level of pure consciousness or spirit. So in that sense, we're all extraterrestrials. We're all extra-dimensional beings. But we've forgotten that. But I think if you look at every great spiritual tradition of the world, you see they have some process of prayer or meditation or yoga or contemplation that's meant to help us understand that, understand what our position in this cosmic hierarchy of is, and get us moving back to our original position.
And let's go back to the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is Matt. George, Mike.
Hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
A little nervous. There's a cave or cavern down in South America,
mm-hmm.
and also one up in the north, around Alaska, maybe further north. And it's these UFOs have been coming in and out of there for a long, long time. And I have a friend of mine that's in intelligence, and he's showed me pictures, and he showed me pictures also of the Russians taking those missiles out of Iraq and all that. But does Michael know anything about these caves? And if he does, I was told by my friend to, if anybody was ever going to go up into there, that they shouldn't do it, that they would be risking
their own lives. Huh?
Yeah.
Michael, have you heard of this?
Well, yes, I have heard of this sort of thing, especially from South America. You know, I've heard a lot about caves down in that region. There's some reports, you know, from some of these ancient Sanskrit writings and from some of the spiritual teachers of India that there used to be a cave system by which you know, some of these beings would travel from Brazil, the area around Brazil where there was a lot of gold, to South India. So we're still hearing about these things today, about these cave systems. I haven't visited any of them myself. I've been to Carlsbad Caverns in New Mexico, but that's as close as I've come to big underground caves.
Okay, thanks for the call, Matt. Appreciate it. It's always good to have someone in the know like that, somebody in. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Junia. I'm calling from Tulsa.
Junia, that's different. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Junia.
Hello, Michael. I'm really impressed with all your research and knowledge, and I would like to submit my conviction and then hear what you have to say. I don't think Darwin should be so hastily dismissed. I believe that he was absolutely correct as far as the body is concerned. The missing link is the spirit, and we descend into creation as spirit germs or spirit seeds that grow to higher levels of consciousness, ultimately to return to where we came from. And while the animistic beings were forming matter, and the animal developed to the noble ape-like animal instead of an animal soul incarnating, when the human spirit on the other side had grown to enough maturity that it was able to handle the physical world, then the human spirit incarnated. And we have since then developed the human body from the animal form that it was originally to this higher form, because we are spiritual beings. so I would like to hear your comment on that, because I think Darwin was absolutely right.
Okay. Well, as far as the spirit beings coming down and being put into the bodies and things like that, that I agree with. The disagreement I would have with Darwin is that I think all the different vehicles or bodies were there, and that what the evolution is not the evolution of the body, but the evolution of the conscious self through the different bodies that are there. You know, just like, you know, in any city, you may have different kinds of houses. All kinds of houses are there. And a person, according to their level of income, you know, a young married couple, for example, they might start out renting an apartment. Then they might buy a small house. And if they prosper, they may get a bigger house. All those things are there, but they just move through them. So I would agree with you. The basic outline that you gave, I would agree with. The only thing I would disagree with is about the physical forms, whether one physical form comes from another, or whether all the different forms were originally there, and it's just that soul, that conscious self, that moves through the different forms. That's what I think the real evolution of consciousness is.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Junie. I appreciate you calling Coast to Coast. First-time caller line. You're up. Hi.
Hi.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
This is Dave in Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Bear with me for a moment. I'll try to articulate this the best I can.
Okay, Dave.
The way my thoughts are going here. But something that you guys mentioned earlier was how everything seems to be put together consciously, otherwise we'd have no life in the universe. And that got me pondering the idea that I truly believe that that human consciousness is infinite and can acquire infinite knowledge. And who's to say that we can't take that and create realms of universes ourselves and use that and harvest those universes for the betterment of humanity? Just kind of an idea that I had.
Well, yeah, I think you're on the track of something that's really true. According to what I found out, you know, through my studies in these ancient Sanskrit writings, is we are part of a cosmic hierarchy, and there are beings that exist at higher levels of this cosmic hierarchy than we are. And some of those at the higher levels of the cosmic hierarchy do have that ability to engineer universes for the positive benefit of the souls that are in them. So that's something that's there. But say if somebody wanted to occupy that position, they would have to qualify themselves by evolving up through that cosmic hierarchy of beings till they got to that level where they would be allowed by, you could say, the supreme cosmic being to have that kind of position. But even then, they wouldn't become infinite. They just become much more powerful than we are in our present position. Because I would say there is already kind of one, I mean, I do believe that there is a God, and that we may get a lot of power from God, but we're never going to become God ourselves. That's the way I would look at it. And that you may even become so powerful that you could become the master of a universe and have a lot to do with the running of that universe, just like, I don't know, maybe if you're a manager of a store or something, like Walmart or something, you know, you may be a manager of the store and have a lot to do with what goes on in it, but still you're not the president of the whole company. So I think we're in a position like that where we could rise up through the cosmic hierarchy of beings until we had some position like that. But I think that whole, it's better just to go back beyond all these universes, back to the position where we really started out with, which is just as pure spiritual beings with nothing to do with matter at all.
All right, let's try east of the Rockies. You're up with Michael Cremo. Hi there.
Morning, George.
Yes,
Michael.
Sir. Hi.
I'm George from Fostoria, Ohio.
Hello, George.
Hello, George.
And hello, and I would like to see what you think about this idea. I'm an abductee, so I've got a different point of view.
All right.
I think somewhere along the time of Neanderthal, something happened, and there was a genetic alteration made, which not only gave Cro-Magnon, which is us, the ability to think, but to reason and, you know, to learn and make tools. That's a pretty big jump for no fossil evidence of a connection there. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, the problem I would have with that is there's fossil evidence showing that humans existed, humans like us, anatomically modern humans, existed, you know, before the time of the Neanderthals even. Because the Neanderthals died out around 30 or 40,000 years ago in Europe, and they existed from, according to the, you know, the current understandings, from maybe about 150,000 years ago or 125,000 years ago until about 30 or 40,000 years ago. So if we're going to say the human beings like us came from these Neanderthals, it would have had to have happened within, you know, the past 100,000 years or so. But there are anatomically modern human skeletal remains from many places in Europe. I mentioned a few of them earlier in the show, from Castagnetolo and from Savona in Italy and from other places that are far older than that. They go back 4 or 5 million years. Here in America, I mentioned earlier in the show, an anatomically modern human skeleton that was found in Macoupin County, Illinois, at 300 million years ago. There are anatomically modern human skeletons found in the California gold mines, about 50 million years old. So that's the problem I would have with this idea that there was some fairly recent genetic modification that led to the anatomically modern human species.
Didn't they find some Egyptian artifacts also, Michael, in some caves in this country?
Well, there are a few, there are a couple of reports like that. One is from the Grand Canyon region. There was a report in a newspaper from Arizona early in the 20th century that told of some Smithsonian institution researchers that were in the Grand Canyon. They found some cave somewhere that was full of Egyptian artifacts. Now, when I tried, that's a report that you see on the internet quite a bit. When I tried to track down the names of any of the researchers that were mentioned by name in the report or find any record of them in the Smithsonian Institution, I wasn't able to do it, and other researchers that were trying to assist me in that were also not successful. So maybe there's something behind it, maybe there isn't. I haven't been able to verify it yet. Another report, I think we have Egyptian-type artifacts coming, is from a place called Burroughs Cave. But as far as I know, the last I heard, the people who made those discoveries are not revealing the location
right,
of the place.
Right, right.
So that makes it difficult for somebody like me, who, you know, who would be trying to convince skeptics of something to the things I mentioned in my books. I like to have some
fact there, huh?
Something, if the site can be identified and you can look at the geological reports about the place and, you know, things like that, it becomes a little easier. Yeah, for me to talk about it. So, but I think there are other signs of, I mean, I think if we really look, I think there are inscriptions, there are other types of evidence throughout the Americas showing that the Americas were in touch with these ancient civilizations in the old world, be they Egyptian or Roman or Libyan or Indian. I think by looking at the architecture in South America and Central America and Mexico, you get some idea of that. But yes, you do find some reports like that.
Old Christopher Columbus was not number one, was he?
No, far from it.
Yep. gets the credit for it, though. Wildcard Line, you're up. Hi there.
Hi there. Got a question for Mike.
Sure thing, sir.
Going back into ancient civilizations and looking that somewhere out there, there has to be a mathematic model for what I call an HPMF, which is a holographic photon magnetic frequency. Apparently, some of the specialists feel that that is the abstract thought pattern, say, in your mind, or actually a possibility one of these days of having a desktop-type cloth that will create a hologram and you can see your children and have a conversation. But it would fit your theory of, say, a neutron natural beam or its subsets able to divide so that you holographs can stay together. Means that prior to all material, your thought patterns can come through. What do you think?
Well, I think that we are kind of like that, because according to these ancient Sanskrit writings, everything comes from vibration, ultimately. Even the elements that we have are kind of solidified vibrations. Everything starts out from an ethereal level, and then from there, the ether solidifies into other elements that solidifies into other elements, so that what we have around us is kind of a projection of forms that exist on some higher level of reality. What we see around us is a reflection of forms that have some real existence on some higher level of reality. So you're kind of expressing it in terms of some modern scientific terminology, but to put it in plainer words, yeah, we're living in a kind of forms that are reflected from some higher level of reality, yes.
Michael's new work, of course, is called Human Devolution. You can pick it up a couple of ways. One is a toll-free number. Here it is, 1-888-465-3686. That's 1-888-465-3686. This new book is called Human Devolution, and of course it's at your big bookstores, Amazon.com as well. If you ever need to just find his website, it's linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and after tomorrow it'll become part of Past Guests, which you'll find on the left-hand side of the screen. Michael, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you very much, George. It's always a pleasure to be with you and your listeners, and the time really goes fast on this show.
It really does. Thanks again, and you take care, Mike.
Okay, bye, George.
Michael Cremo says that we are millions and millions and millions of years old, which is fascinating all by itself. For Nikki Ambrononi, Tom Danheiser, Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisor, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.